we should not be allowing more fossil fuel expansion and development on new areas, anywhere in the U.S., anywhere in the world, because look at what's happening to our climate from all of this development. It's human-induced. We're the ones that are creating the situation. And if we are going to survive as humanity, we have to change how we live. That's the bottom line. And my people have a prophecy about that. And our prophecy, it said we are not protecting these places for ourselves, like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It's for all humankind. And they told us to go out there and tell our story and tell them. We're not doing this for ourselves. We're doing it for all people. Because if that area is ever developed, it will start a cycle of destruction of humanity. And if you listen to other indigenous peoples here, they all have the same prophecies. The same prophecies in their territories that come from their people that say the same thing. Humankind has to change what we're doing.
You're listening to part two of an Arctic special on the 300 to 350 show, featuring New Internationalist co-editor Jess Wirth. We heard last week about how Alaskan native peoples are being impacted already by climate change, and how climate change is threatening the subsistence way of life which they've been practicing for thousands of years. Several Alaskan coastal communities are facing eviction as their increasingly weather-battered lands fall into the sea. The US government is currently failing to provide for their relocation, shamefully abandoning some of their first climate refugees. The village of Kivalina has resorted to suing ExxonMobil and others with a view to getting compensation for their relocation costs. But indigenous communities have been fighting legal battles right throughout Alaska against unsustainable fossil fuel developments, and winning important victories against Shell, the US government, and the US Environmental Protection Agency. This week, we look at the historic Indigenous Peoples Global Summit on Climate Change and its implications for the UN talks in Copenhagen at the end of the year, and what might be done to stop the resource rush the Arctic ice melt is now opening up. We start, though, by looking at the unique position of the Arctic in the climate tipping point story. Here's Jess Wirth.
Well, I spoke to two people. I spoke to a scientist called Katie Walter, and she is one of a kind of growing army of scientists, really, who are studying the Arctic climate systems as they have never been studied before, in recognition of the speed that they're changing and also the importance of that change for the global climate system. So she is working on methane release from Arctic lakes, because we've heard quite a lot about permafrost, and that's the frozen ground melting and releasing methane, which is a really powerful greenhouse gas. But that's also happening in Arctic lakes as they're thawing, and they're releasing an awful lot of methane as well. So she spends a lot of her time camped out in tents in Siberia and the Arctic, like coring these lakes, trying to understand not just, you know, how much methane is being released now, but the problem that climate scientists have is what is the baseline for methane release from permafrost and from lakes, because it hasn't been measured in the past. It's only recently, when we started seeing it melt, that we've suddenly thought, oh God, this is really serious. So how bad is the methane release now compared to 10, 20, 40, 100, 200, 1,000, 2,000 back in the Ice Age? You know, that's what people don't really know. And that's obviously really important to understand the pace of climate change. So what Katie's doing is using ice cores, where they cut right down into the depths of the lake and into the permafrost underneath, to try and see what was happening over the last several 1,000 years. So she's saying, you know, they don't know exactly how much this is different from what's happened before, but what they do know is that things are melting very fast, and it's very worrying because I think there's about twice as much carbon locked in the permafrost as has been already released into the atmosphere by human society. So obviously if that was all to go, then that would push us way over the brink. But then I also interviewed a man called David Coulson, who is director of the International Polar Year, which is this big undertaking of scientific cooperation involving lots and lots of different countries, and it took more scientists to the Arctic than there have ever been before, and it's just come to an end, so now everybody's writing up and kind of trying to come up with their findings. So I talked to him about what the big picture is, really. You know, what do the changes that are happening in the Arctic mean for the rest of the world? And he said that you've really got to break the changes down into three significant areas. There's the changes to the sea ice, there's the thawing of the permafrost, and there's the melting of the Greenland ice cap. In terms of the Arctic sea ice, we've already reached the tipping point whereby we're past the point of no return, which means that we will see an ice-free Arctic Ocean in the summer, sometime in the next probably 15 to 20 years. It could be as soon as 5 years away. It might be a bit further away than that. But he was saying that in a sense it doesn't matter. You know, it's going to happen in this generation. And that's really, really serious because the Arctic sea ice acts as a global thermostat. It helps regulate ocean currents and temperature exchange within the ocean. So it could throw all the ocean currents out of whack, including, for example, the Gulf Stream, which is what keeps the British Isles nice and comparatively warm compared to other parts of the world on the same latitude. And we don't really know exactly how ocean currents are going to be impacted because it hasn't ever really happened before, not in a way that has been scientifically measured. So that's definitely going to happen. And the other thing that the Arctic sea ice does is it reflects the sun's heat back up to the sun. The less ice there is, the more of the sun's heat is absorbed by the ocean, and so that warms up the oceans, and so that contributes to global warming. That's very worrying because it means that we're probably going to see quite rapid climate change as the sea ice recedes more and more, and there's nothing that we can do to stop that. In terms of the permafrost, he was a bit more positive. He said, we haven't reached the point of no return yet, and we need to make sure that we don't, because, like I said, there's twice as much carbon in the permafrost as we've already released into the atmosphere. We can't afford to let that all be emitted. So he was saying that if we can really put into place some serious, serious decarbonisation programmes in the industrialised world at Copenhagen or in the next year or so, put them into practice in the next 5 years, then with any luck, we won't reach a permafrost tipping point. Still going to get an awful lot of permafrost thawing, but it goes very, very deep. So it'll take a long time for the whole lot to thaw. So that was a kind of call to action, really, I think. And then the Greenland ice cap, again, that's been melting really worryingly fast over the last few years. And one of the big findings of the International Polar Year is that the speed of the melt means that whereas the IPCC estimated about a 40 centimetre sea level rise by the end of the century as a result of the Greenland ice cap melting, they now think it's going to be between a metre and a metre and a half, which is obviously significantly more. So that's also very worrying. But he was saying that the Greenland ice cap is so thick, it's like 3 kilometres thick in places, that it's really going to take a very long time for the whole thing to melt. And so there's definitely still time to save the ice cap, or save the majority of the ice cap, again, if we act now.
Global warming may trigger conflict between Russia and the US, according to an EU report. They are both seeking control of the Arctic's vast energy resources. As the ice caps melt and the area opens up for exploitation of its raw materials, the stakes are becoming ever higher.
It's barren, cold and inhospitable, but apparently full of oil. Suddenly the Arctic looks a whole lot more attractive, particularly to five different nations who all want a slice of it. Now at a conference in Greenland, they've said they'll cooperate to protect the environment. But is the race to the top of the world really over? The Great Arctic Oil Rush. This is Inside Story.
It's one of the most thumping ironies of climate change, I think, that because the Arctic is warming up, because the permafrost is melting, because the sea ice is receding, it's making these fossil fuel resources more accessible than they ever have been before. So it's actually making it possible to extract them when it hasn't been before.
And possible to incur more climate change by burning.
Absolutely. But I don't think the oil companies see it that way. There are vast quantities of oil and gas and other minerals underneath the Arctic. It's been estimated that about 25% of the world's unexploited oil is actually in the Arctic.
Wow.
I mean, nobody actually knows. It's an estimate because you don't know until you start sucking it up. But that's what a US Geological Survey said. When I first started reading up on the Arctic and trying to identify what the big issues were, the one thing that there was a huge amount of media coverage over was this kind of clashes over Arctic sovereignty, the various different countries that have territory bordering the Arctic Ocean, which is the US because of Alaska, Canada, Norway, Denmark because of Greenland, and Russia. That they were all sort of squaring up to each other and trying to stake claims over the Arctic Ocean floor so that they could exploit the resources that were there. I was thinking, gosh, you know, there's a potential for conflict in the Arctic over the next few years. You know, maybe we're looking at the beginning of a new Cold War where back in the day the USSR and the US confronted each other over the Arctic and so on. And there have been a few things that have happened that have sort of fueled those stories. Like a couple of years ago, the Russians cut a hole in the sea ice at the North Pole and sunk this submarine all the way to the bottom of the ocean and planted a Russian flag on the on the ocean floor under the North Pole, essentially saying, we own the rights to the North Pole now and everything that is buried underneath it. And that really wound up the Canadians. And, you know, journalists really loved this. And they were saying, oh, this is the shape of things to come and so on. So I interviewed Professor Michael Byers from Canada to sort of find out what was going on and what future he saw in terms of the big powers who currently own the Arctic. And he was very adamant that all of this has been totally blown out of proportion by journalists looking for a good story and by politicians basically playing to their domestic audience when they're trying to get elected to something. So the Russian stunt happened during the Russian elections. Canada have been sort of making a big hoo-ha about the Northwest Passage, which is this fabled route from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean through the Canadian Arctic islands that would cut thousands of miles off shipping routes between Europe and Asia. And Europeans have been trying to get through the Northwest Passage and have failed for hundreds and hundreds of years because it's always choked with sea ice. And as the sea ice is starting to recede, the Northwest Passage is opening up really for the first time to commercial shipping. And there's this disagreement between the US and Canada as to whether it's internal Canadian waters, which Canada say they are, so that means they get to control exactly what goes through it, or whether they're international waters, which is what the US wants, which means anything can go through it. But he was saying that, you know, really that's only been an issue because the Foreign Minister of Canada has wanted to get elected to be chief of NATO, and that actually there are very few disagreements between the Arctic powers. The dominant political paradigm is one of cooperation. They all sit together on the Arctic Council. They all pretty much agree on each other's borders. They're all currently mapping the ocean at the moment, but there's this law called, well, the Convention on the Law of the Sea, that's quite specific about what you can claim in terms of territory off of your coastline and what should just be international waters. So he thinks it's a bit of a storm in a teacup. He knows much more about it than I do, so I'm sure there's a lot of truth to that, but I can't help but think that as resources like oil and gas and minerals become scarcer in the rest of the world, and if we're hitting peak oil and so on, then the price of oil shoots up, you know, there is going to be more and more attention being focused on the Arctic and on access to Arctic resources, and there is potential for conflict there, I would imagine. And I think maybe what needs to happen, various people have sort of mooted this, is that there needs to be some kind of international agreement, whether it's a moratorium on resource exploitation or whether it's an agreement to phase out resource exploitation or not open up new areas within the Arctic, sort of along the lines of the Antarctica Treaty, although it would have to be quite different, that really something like that needs to be agreed in order to prevent future conflict and to preserve what is an incredibly fragile ecosystem that really can't support the levels of exploitation that are being planned for it at the moment. So we can't afford to just leave it up to governments and oil companies to parcel everything out amongst themselves and merrily profit, because actually the planet can't afford that. So everyone needs to start paying more attention to what's going on in the Arctic.
Earlier this year, Hillary Clinton gave a speech on the 50th anniversary of the Antarctic Treaty, saying that there were important lessons to be learnt from the treaty for the current situation in the Arctic. In the face of conflicting territorial claims back in the late 1950s, nations came together to agree to put aside their differences and dedicate the Antarctic to purely peaceful, scientific uses. In 1991, an environmental protocol to the treaty was agreed, which put commercial resource extraction off limits. Something similar in the Arctic could help us avoid crossing those critical climate tipping points that Jess was talking about earlier. Back in Alaska, legal battles rage against fossil fuel developments. The fight has been weighted unfairly against indigenous peoples for several reasons, including a 1968 piece of legislation called the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. This law turned ownership of some native lands over to new profit-making bodies known as native corporations, rather than giving the ownership to native peoples' traditional governing bodies. Indigenous peoples are now working to overturn this legislation and regain sovereignty over much of the Arctic. Here's Robert Thompson, Vietnam vet and leading campaigner to preserve the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, talking about the effect an oil spill would have on his land and the oil company tactic of bribery that has attempted to split and buy out local opposition to oil drilling.
And so in terms of your community and the whole kind of ecosystem here, what impact would an oil spill have?
It could be the end of our culture that we've had for thousands of years. If they have an oil spill, they can't clean it up. It could be an extinction of marine mammals.
Mm-hmm.
No, nobody will say what effect would a major spill have on the whales. It can't be a positive effect. Mm-hmm. And they ask the question, how long will the oil be toxic in the Arctic Ocean? And nobody will answer that. Shirley Oil was here, and I asked them that, if there's any studies. And they said, oh, there is an ongoing study, but it's not done yet. And then I said, oh, then you can't say it, how long it will be toxic. And they can't. The study hasn't been done. And the oil is still toxic from the Exxon Valdez oil spill 20 years later.
Mm-hmm.
So most likely in the Arctic Ocean, it would be longer because it's cold water.
Yeah. I understand that some people in this community are supportive of the oil development. Is that because people feel like they need the money?
Well, there's some people who are somewhat supportive of onshore development. They've been told for years we've got to support onshore so they don't mm-hmm. go offshore,
uh-huh.
which they've been lied to. Sometimes the native who live nearby are in favor of it.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll come in, and it's happening here. the oil industry will come in, and here in Koktovik they're proposing about $1 million in economic stimulus type projects.
Oh, really?
Yeah, after the after Shell Oil lost the first round on the offshore oil lease sales, their CEO said, maybe we moved a little too soon. We got to go there and let the people know we're their good neighbor. We're their friends and we're there to help them.
Mm-hmm.
And if they need some infrastructure, we can provide that. And then shortly after, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation came in, and they're talking of getting $500,000 from oil industry and $500,000 their own that will be available for local people to get into oil services, oil field activity, you know, business ventures that are related to the oil.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially what they're doing is come in to buy people off so they'll get the support. But $1 million for proposed multi-billion dollar projects, it's a drop in the bucket. It just costs of doing business.
Was it you that mentioned to me that Shell sent Santa Claus into the village?
Well, not Shell, the oil industry.
Oh, the oil industry.
It might be British Petroleum or Chevron Tech, one of the oil companies. Yeah. They routinely send Santa Claus as presents for the kids. Oh, yeah, when we have a spring whaling festival, they'll send watermelons and fruit. And they've come in and put radios on the fishing boat or the whale boats.
Mm-hmm.
And before they used to provide gasoline. It's, you know, public relations. The more the more you come in, and then they send people here to, you know, to be friends with the local people. You know, to get to know them and say, well, it's part of the, it's part of a strategy. It's not like they really care. It's just, well, they care about oil production.
Mm-hmm.
So
our Arctic journey is nearly at an end. And you can find links and references for the programmes at www.climateradio.org. The final question I asked Jess was about the Historic Indigenous Peoples Global Summit on Climate Change, which took place in Anchorage, Alaska back in April, and its implications for the UN climate talks in Copenhagen at the end of the year. Thanks for listening.
The reason that the summit was organised was because Copenhagen is approaching and Indigenous peoples are really at the front line of climate change and they have no formal voice in the negotiations and they have no formal rights in the face of climate change as it stands. And so this was an attempt to get everybody together to attempt to agree a common platform and to speak with more of a unified voice, and then to articulate what it is that Indigenous peoples want going into Copenhagen at a much higher level. So, yeah, there were about 300 people there from all over the world. So I think, you know, most of the kind of major Indigenous populations and regions were represented.
It's an amazing thing. Do they have summits usually?
No. It took 2 years to organise.
Wow.
And they'd had pre-meetings in each of the different regions where a lot more people had got together and had sort of mandated their representatives to speak on their behalf. So the whole of the first day was just taken up with regional report backs. So, yeah, the first day was just utterly fascinating because it was a trip around the world of what issues Indigenous peoples are facing, particularly in relation to climate change everywhere. And what really came through was a very common experience, even though they live in such different parts of the world and such different environments. I think because Indigenous peoples have such a close relationship with nature and with the land, they're much more sensitive and susceptible to changes that those of us that live in cities would barely notice. But one of the really strong messages that came through for the rest of us was that Indigenous peoples aren't just victims in the face of climate change, they're also the people that have the knowledge and the skills and the experience to live in harmony with nature and to live a completely sustainable lifestyle. And that's what the rest of us have lost and that we need to regain really, really quickly. And they are there offering their wisdom to us, and I think we would do well to listen. I mean, the other thing that came through really clearly is not just that Indigenous people's livelihoods and sort of long-term existence is being threatened by climate change, but that also they're being really affected by a lot of the false solutions that are being put in place supposedly to tackle climate change. So, you know, biofuels, throwing them off their lands, GM crops, GM trees replacing traditional forests, geoengineering, carbon trading, carbon offsetting. You know, there's this huge long list of new problems that they're having to grapple with because they are the kind of climate change solutions that are being imposed on them by the West. So that was a real eye-opener as well. And in terms of outcomes, they issued a declaration, and it's really amazing, and I'd really recommend that everybody reads it. It's a really nice, succinct statement of how the Indigenous peoples of the world see climate change and see what the path forward should be. And it is very much a call to action for the rest of the world. It is placing the responsibility to act firmly on the shoulders of industrialised governments. The targets that they are calling for to be agreed at Copenhagen are much more in keeping with the current science, because the targets that they're working to at the moment in Copenhagen are really out of date. You know, the climate is changing much faster than the IPCC thought when it set those targets a few years ago. So I think, to double check this, but I think the targets that they've advocated for are 47% reductions by 2020 and 95% by 2050.
From industrialised countries.
From industrialised countries, from a 1990 baseline. Yeah, and they call for an end to false solutions, an end to carbon trading and market-based mechanisms to solve climate change, because it doesn't. The one thing that they couldn't come to an agreement on, ironically, is whether or not to call for a moratorium on fossil fuel development on Indigenous lands. And it was the Arctic peoples that actually blocked it for all of the reasons I've been talking about, that actually they stand to gain financially from fossil fuel development on their lands. And some of them are quite closely connected to oil companies, whilst others are very much in opposition. So that is an ongoing disagreement within Indigenous communities within the Arctic, whereas pretty much the rest of the Indigenous world is united in supporting a moratorium on fossil fuel development in Indigenous lands. So those two perspectives are both in the final declaration. And then the final thing that they're calling for really is a formal voice in the negotiations and for their rights to live the lifestyles that they've lived for many thousands of years to be recognised and to be enshrined. So I think it was a very important moment for the Indigenous movement. What they did was they formally presented the declaration to the president of the UN General Assembly, who came along and participated in the summit, and he pledged to take the declaration back to the UN, and whenever he had an opportunity to address the negotiators, the governments, the Security Council, whoever it was, he would draw their attention to this declaration and the demands that were in it and do what he could to raise the profile of it. So they've got friends in high places.